Welcome back. I'm Dr. Stefan Obini, orthopedic surgeon at UCSF and host of the DocSF podcast. Today, we present the final installment of our Startups We Love series. Our moderator, Dr. Michael Havig, CEO of HealthMe, will introduce TrackPatch Health, Proprio, Vizier, and Think Surgical, companies pushing the limits of digital orthopedics. Let's join Michael on the DocSF stage.
Well, thanks, everybody. Hope everyone had a great lunch. Mike Havig, orthopedic practicing surgeon still and founder of HealthMe. We'll get the slides going here. We have Richard Bolander from TrackPatch first, and he's going to tell us a bit about that. So turn it over to you, Richard.
Hi, everyone. And thanks to Dr. Benia for inviting me back again for a second year. I really wanted to kind of just talk about what we've done as a company over the last year since the last time I presented. A lot of different changes and kind of focus. So I want to cover that. So just a little bit about my background briefly is, so I have a PhD in biomedical engineering, as well as for the last 10 years, I pretty much have been developing wearable technologies, everything from complete architecture, algorithms, data analytics, everything from that, but had been primarily developing wearables for concussion and concussion monitoring. And it's really over the last 4 years that I got into orthopedics, and really over the last year that I jump into the president role for the company. And really over that last year, a lot of the things that I had to think about now are very different compared to developing the technology. It's what do you have to do to actually get it adopted, or how do you actually get a customer with wearables? And so really over the last year, we've kind of come down to these three big concepts of ease of use, demonstrated clinical value, but even more so the demonstrated economic value of using these technologies in order to push initiatives along. So at a high level, the TrackPatch Knee system consists of two wearable devices that stay on the patient and collect data continuously for about 13 hours a day, but also allow real-time streaming so the patient can do guided exercises at any location. We also capture subjective and objective data throughout the patient care pathway, as well as all that information goes up to a server and can be looked at by providers. But even more so, it's used by us to help provide guidance to providers on what to do with a specific patient. So a lot of what we focused on in terms of ease of use is we had to take the clinic out of it as much as possible. Doctors are too busy and clinical staff is too busy. So we had to do a redesign of reducing our COGS, as well as doing direct-to-patient shipment at home and creating packaging and things that allows a patient to do that, or with minimal guidance with us over the phone or with a video. And when we talk about some of our patients that we have, these are ones that aren't very tech savvy, and so they require a little bit more help. But additionally, I talked about a lot of research we published over the last couple of years about what a standardized recovery looks like. And what we've done is I've integrated those bounds into the software. So now that we can create an objective standard of, is this patient on track or not? And so from that, now we have this way to say, okay, if you, for example, have 100 patients, we can tell you which of the 15 or 20 are the ones that are not performing as intended, and then provide guidance to your clinical team. So beyond that, the next thing we had to do is demonstrate clinical value. And over the last couple of years, we've had a very strong partnership with the University of Miami, where they have dedicated staff and 4 surgeons using the technology, and it's just part of how they do care there. And that population, in terms of social determinants, there is cases that need a lot of additional attention. We have like 40 to 50% that are English as a second language, low income, high comorbidities. So it's good for them to have that additional connection from the view of the organization. A lot with that as well is we are going to be publishing another paper this year on the compliance of the technology within their system and how it relates to social determinants of health, and see which predictors will predict compliance. But on top of that, I've noticed trends associated with compliance, meaning how much more is someone going to use the technology if they don't have to do anything with it versus if they have to actively engage in that. And so if we're looking at ways on how to risk a patient, just having them put it on their leg can be a pretty good amount of it, and it gives us a lot of information. It's low lift for low motivated patients. And so that's one of the things we're trying to do. Beyond that, what we're trying to do with Ochsner Health, for example, is looking at other aspects with regarding how home health PT and other aspects, outpatient versus home health, and who does it better. Time's moving faster than I thought it would be, so I'm going to go a little bit quicker here. So the next thing that we're doing is with in terms of demonstrating value, what we're really trying to do is reduce physical therapy, but guided by physical therapists within post-surgical windows. And what that's allowing us to do is that through white papers and IRB studies that we're doing is demonstrating how we are creating those reduced costs. Additionally, with the economic models, what we're really focusing on this point is we're saying that we are an adjunct to reduce cost, not an add-on to standard patient of care. We don't want to be throwing another technology on top of a standard PT protocol, on top of another technology. Patients get overloaded with that. Additionally, we're focusing very heavily on value-based care, but it's a very polarizing term. And so we understand that. But for example, with TEAM and CMI and CMS will continue to push towards more and more bundles in the future. But we've also are working with private payers and within their ortho bundles to help increase the opportunity for docs to gain share. And so for what we're doing in 2026, the biggest things we're doing is we're focusing on different protocols for private and public payers. There's different protocols for ASCs versus hospitals. And then we're working on developing connected ecosystems with different partners as well. So I think the last point within this is that to get adoption, there has to be a way for a physician to profit in some sort of way. If that doesn't happen, you don't get the alignment that comes down from that. And that's why we're focusing on using the technology to create great gain sharing opportunities for physicians that they can advocate for themselves, either in a hospital system or with their private payers, if they're, for example, in ASCs. So I think that's it. I'll stop from that.
All right. That's great. Thanks, Richard. Yeah, so thanks a lot. You know, it's interesting because this morning we saw some talks with more kind of camera and video-based systems, and you kind of mentioned the study you had on compliance. Tell us, you know, what would be the advantages of a device like yours over camera, or do they work together, or what do you think there?
Yeah, I think it's the difference between one technology and another is they each have pros and cons. And what we see with, like, for example, Ochsner patients or Miami patients, that high comorbidities, low mobility, those types of things, they don't want to get in front of a camera. They don't even really want to move. And so they are able to just pop something onto their skin, and then we're continuously monitoring them for those 13 hours. So they may not want to do exercises, and we see that happen where they don't, but we're still getting things like, what was their behavior throughout the day? How much time of the day did they spend with it straight? Do you want them spending 80% of their day with their legs straight at 2 weeks? Probably not. And so that's the type of information we can get from someone that doesn't even really want to be involved in their care.
No, that's great. That makes a lot of sense. Well, we'll try and stay on time here and move on to Gabriel Jones, founder of Proprio.
Super happy to be here to support the community today. Not here to present a company, here to present an idea and a movement actually we are all believers in, which is real-time data. We all believe that data across the care continuum is the answer to clinical and economic problems we have in healthcare. So you have a bunch of believers here, and obviously you've shown up, so you believe in that movement. So that's what I'm here to talk about today. Now we'll start with the limitations of today. Surgical navigation is essentially an X-ray pinned to the body with a metal clip. It's like asking surgeons to work miracles every day with a handful of Polaroids. It's insane to expect miracles every day in this way. We need to do better. This is 35-year-old technology, and this is driving a lot of robotics in the space. Static 2D images like MapQuest to get around the block. You would never do that today. So how could you measure the main goal of the surgery, whether it's knee, hip, shoulder, foot, or ankle? It's an alignment problem. The curvature correction of the spine, that's the goal, to drive a better outcome for that patient. You can't do that with Polaroids. We have fragmented data across the entire care continuum, especially in the hospital, with the EMR and the PAC system, and the data that's in the surgeon's brain. We need to unify these things across platforms. And the only way for a surgeon to get a definitive sense of what they're achieving in the surgery is more radiation-based imaging, an X-ray, the O-arm, et cetera. Our friends at UCSF just came out with an amazing paper that said 1 in 20 cancer cases will be driven by CTs. We have to stop this. And all of this is really limited by the feedback loop itself. You shouldn't have to wait 2 years to know what you achieve for that patient on that bed in that day. So we need to collapse and condense the feedback loops with technology. My good friend, Dr. Bervin, said it well. We're practicing medicine at an inflection point from the old to the new. So let's talk about the old. So how do we know it's not working? NIH has great numbers on this, showing that we waste $20 billion a year in the U.S. alone on failed back surgery syndrome. 40% of patients experience persistent pain and complications after surgery. It's not good enough. We have to do better. So we need, not want, a paradigm shift to something we call surgical intelligence across the entire care continuum, from imaging and planning and prior authorization to measurement of the goals and what we're actually achieving in the surgery and how that connects to the outcome. We need to be able to give surgeons the tools to adapt in real time to what happens in the operating room. We have to capture a tremendous amount of data multimodally, not just cameras, not just sensors. All of these things need to come together into sort of one system to rule them all. Turns out AI is very good at learning. So you need the whole thing. No more point solutions, no more one-offs, no more workarounds. That's a big ambition. So how are we contributing to this? We invented what we think is a supercomputer and the most sophisticated sensor array ever to be in an operating room. Hell of a claim. Hell of a claim. Let's dive into the technology. You need to be able to see in real time and high definition to be able to see what you're doing in the OR. Track every sensor or robotic end effector, if you will, that comes into that scene, every instrument that is used in the performance of the surgery, and update everything in real time in 3D. Not a concept, not a demo. A multi-time FDA-cleared platform that's already impacted hundreds of patients with what we believe the best outcomes in the history of spine surgery. That's a good start. But it's really complicated. We got to simplify it. Surgeons are dealing with all kinds of workarounds in the OR and managing a lot of complexity. More complications in their workflow and their mind share is not the answer. We need to be able to go from red to yellow to green. Did you achieve your goals for that patient on that table on that day? And when have we done enough? Enough to achieve a significantly improved, not 10%, 300% improved outcome for that patient on that day, verifiably. So improved clinical outcomes, improved economic outcomes, and the two are intertwined and we shouldn't be ashamed to say it. That's the reality of the business of healthcare. So the new platforms, the new technologies need to achieve both. That's table stakes. Interesting concept. Let's get very clinical. This is a landmark case from Duke. High BMI, older patient, about 65 years old, I believe. Really challenging, especially in the lumbar spine with blood pooling and a high BMI patient. Had to do a lot of work to get there to see what we're achieving in the case. So I'll decipher this for you. This is real-time 3D information, no radiation, a matter of seconds in the OR to see the curve correction the surgeon was trying to achieve across lumbar 4 to S1 or L1 to S1. I'll translate. This is the holy grail of musculoskeletal surgery, embodied in spine surgery. It's global alignment in lumbar in real time with no radiation. I'll say it again. So the surgeon was trying to achieve 31 degrees and he got to 23. And that tells him maybe we need to do a little bit more work. That's that adaptation in real time in the surgery. But across L1 to S1, I think we were looking for 41 degrees. That was the plan. He's already got to 44. Actually, the patient's body relaxed and had more mobility than he anticipated. So he's 3 degrees over what his goal was. Maybe we've done enough there. And in this case, I know that they saved at least tens of thousands of dollars on the implants because they did less bony work, less bone graft. That's saving money for the hospital. The probability of that patient having to use more opioids to recover is decreased, right? The clinical and economic outcomes are better. And if we looked at something like a GAP score, the probability that this patient has a revision surgery within 2 years probably went from something like a 50-50 proposition to under 10%. I'll say it again, a 10% improvement is not good enough. We need 300-400% improvement. So this is a landmark case. We've now seen many of these. We need to take this to the world. And we all need to do this in our own way. But that's not enough either. We need to impact the economics too. So I'll show you two things very quickly and close. Every surgeon needs to be treated like LeBron James or Steph Curry on their phone after the surgery, and they need real data from that real-time data capture from what they just achieved with their team that they can look on their phone and have a cup of coffee and say, how did we do? And why did we do that? Redefining the outcome to the granular mini game, of which there are many throughout surgery that every surgeon is trying to master, but tying that mini outcome to the outcome for the patient, much faster than waiting 2 years to see what we achieved. And of course, that's tied to alignment as well. This is going to change how we do research in the space. And lastly, economics. I know I'm a couple seconds over, but I'll forfeit my Q&A. This is an autonomous system built off of LLMs, if you're familiar, with RAG and RAFT overlaid to automatically bill the surgery for you with 100% accuracy. No surgeon should ever write a note again. You shouldn't have to talking to a microphone, but you should never do speech to text or use dragon speech or nuance or abridge. Those guys' days are numbered. It's not about the EMR. We're upstream of the EMR here. This is before you get to the EMR. The economics are taken care of for you. This is what medical technology companies need to do. a one-off solution in the OR is no longer good enough, and we need to set the bar really high for this movement. I know you all believe in that too. So that's why we're here.
That's awesome. Thanks, Gabriel. Very impressive. Just real quick, since we're a little over on the Q&A, I think you made a good point. We've seen all these great solutions out here. How do you tie it all together?
I didn't catch the question. I was apologizing for taking his.
I'm sorry. No. How do you tie this together? So you've got, you're creating notes, you've got the imaging, you're eliminating CT. You mentioned some preoperative workflow type things. Tell us a little bit more about how you're.
Yeah, it's not the easy way, right? It's be a hardware and a software company, be computer vision and real AI, not bullshit AI. It's, you know, raise a lot of money, do pre-op, intra-op, post-op. It's work with partners because we can't boil the entire ocean ourselves. So we're not an implant company. We work with implant companies. We're not a clinical research organization, but we provide them with data and make their jobs more efficient and easier. And really looking at the entire ecosystem, hence the first point I opened with is this is not about one company. We're all working on similar parts of the same problem. We've got to find ways to collaborate together to drive the entire industry to think this way about real-time data.
Yeah, that's a good insight. That's, I think, what we need. We have a lot of great solutions. Let's pull them all together somehow. But anyway, up next, Doug Fairbanks with Visy.
Thank you. I'm going to try to move around a little bit because we're after lunch. We're all getting kind of worn down here. And I'm going to try to make this entertaining to you. My name's Doug. This is Visy, a spatial 3D spatial computing company for surgical robotics, navigation, AR, VR. Here's a disclaimer. Now, I like to come to this meeting. It's one of my favorites. I was actually gave my first big speech as the CEO of the company at JP Morgan at DocSF in 2023. So I actually want to rehash that because I think it's a fun conversation to have. I was going to crop a bunch of hair onto my head, but I don't think anybody would have believed it. I was bald when I started, and I'm more bald now. If we look back to the 1975 to 1985, computing, personal computing was exploding. And if you look at this, I tried to put together the best list I could of all the companies that were coming out during that period. And when you think about what they gave us, many of them gave us this blinking command prompt, right? And you're like, oh, that doesn't realize all the benefits that the computer has to offer us, right? It's kind of laborious to plug things into it. And what we really wanted was something like this, a mouse, right? Where I could move it and click on the thing I wanted and it would do the thing I wanted it to do. It was a feature that unlocked the capability of a system. And two companies leaned in on this, Apple with Lisa and IBM with Microsoft. And of those lists, you can see that there are clear winners. When I first did this speech, you know, the market cap for Apple was $2 trillion. That was January 2023. You wouldn't have guessed, but now both companies are almost double the market cap, right? Which is pretty incredible. And the one point I'll make here is that think about the amount of mind share computing takes up in your life, right? How many times you have a conversation about AI or a computer. And it probably is fitting that these companies are having more and more value as more of our life is centered around using a computer. Now, I'll take it back to medicine here, which is we maybe experienced the greatest adoption of technology in the history of medicine. Here's a list of some of the robotic systems that are entering the space. I'm going to pull it back to ortho and talk about my father. This is a good anecdote that I've used several times. I took my dad to get his robotic knee done, and he said, Doug, what kind of surgeon did you take me to? He actually went to a very world-famous surgeon that did a good job. But he said, he operated on my thigh and my ankle. What's wrong? He couldn't find my knee. And we chuckle about that. We still tell the joke. And I explained to him, Dad, that's because, you know, you have to put pins and trackers onto the bone to be able to see it. Now, when we think about what happens here, you know, you think about the amount of data that the system operates with. Very little, right? We see pins and arrays and trackers. But the truth of the matter is, if I go back, this is what the information that the robotic system or the navigation system is operating on. A handful of dots in space. Hardly robust optical data. And when you look at the literature, it's actually really supported here. The FDA issued a warning, a safety communication that says the use of these tracking technologies can lead to patient deaths, life-threatening injuries, failed to border or prolonged procedures. So we acknowledge, hey, this is a challenge for us and it's a mess. And like Gabriel mentioned, for 35 years, we've just accepted it. We said, okay, that's it. Well, when we talk to surgeons, we say, hey, how could you do better? Simplifying image registration would be huge. We need robotic systems to save time and tissue. Pinless robotics, that would be the holy grail. So what did we do as a company? We said, it's time to see the patient. This is about 3 years old, this image. This is a single 3D scan that came out of a device that we invented. size, scale, color accurate, right? You can create a superposition of the preoperative image. And really, that's what we are as a company. We are a 3D spatial computing company that creates a hardware and software solution, a new way of 3D scanning, high precision, high speed, customizable, IP protected, and delivers objective registration. And more importantly, like Gabriel mentioned, real-time tracking. And what does that do for you? Well, we'll get to it. Makes your life easier and hopefully makes the procedure better. If you look at the left side of the screen there, you see 300 points gathered on the distal femur. You know, with our system, in a fraction of a second, you can get 400,000 data points. And it's objective, not subjective, and orders of magnitude more precise. We're talking 200 micron accuracy, right? So as we think about it, the company has been around for a couple of years. We're growing up. We have more and more innovations as we keep going. And we're really excited to protect our innovations with our IP. Now, I'm going to take you and make this more real. Has anybody in this room used the surgical robotic system? Maybe we just wake up and just, oh, there you go. Yes, yes, we got some takers. There's one, two, three, four. I'm writing this down for a survey. Some robotic takers, right? I went online and I looked for this, pinning and registration. And actually, you have to go to some pretty far out websites to do this, but this is the three biggest companies in the orthopedic space. Zimmer Biomet, DePuy Synthes, and Stryker. And they don't actually publish this part of the procedure when they advertise online, right? They don't show the pinning and the array. And I've sped these up at 3 and 5 times. But these are all surgical steps that you surgeons have to go to in order to realize the benefit of the computer. Think about that. You're taking time while the patient is under anesthesia to do something for a computer? That doesn't make sense to me, right? The computer should help you and get to it. So in each one of these, there's lots of steps. We got to meticulously take these points, figure out where they are and carry it out, right? And then gather and range of motion. And we think there's a better way. So what have we done? We've gotten busy and created a solution. Here's registration. You know, we take those points, 1, 2, 3, distal femur. Here it happens at Visi, you know, boom, fraction of eye. Here we're going to get Andrew's hand in the picture. And boom, co-registered a femur. Looked at the tissue, saw it, recognized where it was, and then on this one, matched it to a preoperative image. That's one step, but registration doesn't get you rid of pins and arrays, right? So we need to do tracking. Tracking's a harder problem, and Gabriel mentioned it, real time. How do you go as fast as things can go? Now, there's lots of processing that happens in the background, but here, Andrew's gonna pick this femur up, and what's going on is that we're looking at this femur, and we're taking a ton of pictures, and we're overlaying some imagery and we're extracting how that goes. Then we're co-registering it to a preoperative image in some cases, and it's spitting out the registration over and over, in this case, over 25 hertz and getting faster. And we go from there, right? Which is, hey, what happens when you balance a knee? If you can see things, you really need to be able to get soft tissue data. And so we can watch multiple bones at a single time and measure what the soft tissue's behaviors are in a knee. And we're really excited about the progression of the technology as it moves towards the market. Now, last year we thought about, hey, how do we really prove out what tracking is? Because if it's right, it should be silent. It should operate in the background. It should not do anything. It should be innocuous to the procedure. And so what I asked the team to do is mount a 3D scanner onto a robotic arm. And what you're seeing here is the scanner watching the tissue in real time and the scanner driving the robotic arm. So it's saying, hey, I can see that there's a femur there. I know where the femur is. I know where it's going to go. I'm going to go where it's going to go. And the analogy we use is, you know, taking a picture of a race car while driving on a track in a race car next to it and hanging out the window holding a camera, right? Very hard problem. And the team complains, you could have made that easier a lot of different ways. I said, I didn't ask for comments. Let's just do it. But we did do it. I'm actually not that bad of a boss, I hope. At any rate, so what's the next step, right? We went to AUKUS and we went to Academy this year and everyone said, well, great, Doug, but what happens when you put a saw in the field? Is the whole thing gonna catch on fire? And I said, maybe, but we'll figure it out. And so what we did is we didn't have a surgical robot. We tend to run pretty lean there in Austin. So we made our own surgical robot. In 4 weeks, a bunch of engineers came together and we strapped a saw to the end of a KUKA robot and we turned it into a surgical robot. And really the goal was to say, hey, look, can you essentially execute a procedure? And so what you're seeing here is a surgical robot that we built in 4 weeks. We're not going to sell a robot. We're not a robot company. But Andrew's taking it through various cuts. He's saying, take me to the cut plane for the anterior cut. Take it to the posterior chamfer. Take it to the distal cut. And we're able to execute all the cuts that are needed in a procedure with a robot, with the scanner being the only thing. No pins, no rays in reality. And I'm going to wrap it up here. We've taken the technology, applied it in shoulders, applied it in cranny procedures and hip procedures and spine procedures. This is Vizzy. There's more to see. Thank you for being a great audience.
Hey, thanks a lot, Doug. We're a little over, but probably maybe time for a quick question. So I've been in robotic surgery for about 15 years, and your technology's been around for a while. And why didn't Stryker like said, sign us up, let's go? How do you get these companies with this ancient technology to move forward? Because I want to see it as a surgeon who uses a robot.
Yeah, I'm sure the people on this stage know that sometimes convincing people of the benefits of something new in this industry is challenging. And so you got to convince and convince and convince. But I think that the industry is waking up to the benefits here. And I think that of all things, the credit goes to the surgeons who call me regularly, but also call their companies and say, I want this. This is the future. This is what the solution is. And sometimes the laggard in all of this is a big strategic company. That being said, I think Stuart and I are going to make a surgical robot for our AUKUS in a couple of weeks, and it'll be great.
Very cool. Well, with that being said, good segue into Stuart's presentation on Think Surgical. Let's hear it for Stuart Simpson.
Thank you. Just before I start, can you please put up your hands if you've spent more than 20 hours in an airplane this year? Oh, everybody. Great. You have been exposed to the same amount of radiation as a patient getting a low-dose CT, lower limb CT before a robotic case. And, you know, you did it for business or pleasure. They're talking about healthcare. So I want us all to keep this whole CT thing in context. Thank you for the invitation to be back, Stefano, because I was there in JP Morgan 29 years ago, whatever it was, 2017, 2016, and how far you've come. So congratulations. I thought in keeping with the spirit of the meeting, I would focus on how technology gets integrated into healthcare. And it's because it has to become invisible and it has to have a business model that works. And I'm going to use total knee robotics as a case study. So the market leader is not invisible in the operating room. There's three different components. There's lots of wires hanging out, but it doesn't leave much space for the operation, as Dr. Unis presented this morning. And one of the solutions would be to step back and let the robot do more autonomy. I actually think the opposite. I think the opportunity is to get rid of the robotic arm, which is what we're doing. We have a miniaturized wireless robot, which sits on the Mayo stand next to your other instruments, removes most of the manual instruments required in a case, and you pick it up and use it when you need it. And you're up close and personal with the surgical site. And it achieves the same level of precision and accuracy as the large robotic arm. It is much more efficient and faster in the operating room. Not just all those steps you talked about, Doug, but skin to skin, which is what matters. Obviously, the first phase of robots has transformed total knee replacement. And I think there's a very strong case to be made that this will become the standard of care in some shape or form. But the business model is a challenge. If you want to use one of those robots, you have to use the implants that come from that manufacturer. And by the way, in case you hadn't worked out, the whole game is not about selling robots or improving outcomes. It's about selling more implants, because that's where all the revenue is. That's where all the profit is in this industry. It's a massive industry. So we did a survey of 250 orthopedic surgeons. Collectively, they performed 50,000 knee replacements per year, which is about 5%, 6% of the entire market, a pretty large sample, double blinded. They didn't know who was asking the questions and we didn't know who was responding to the questions. When you ask them a question about which implant would you prefer to use to achieve the best outcomes for your patients, and you ask if all of those implants are available on every robot. And we ask the other question, which is, which robot would you prefer to use to get the best outcomes for your patients if all of the implants were available on that robot? And the reality is that the match was only 47%. The mismatch was 53%, which means that for 47% of those surgeons to use a surgical robot to perform a total knee replacement, there was no compromise. But for 53% of them, there was a clinical compromise involved. And I know a lot of surgeons, and I know that clinical compromise is not part of their DNA. So our business model, we started as an implant agnostic robotic technology, and we have 8 implants on that implant agnostic platform, but we only really cover 8% of the market with those partnerships. So are we truly implant agnostic? Are we truly open? Obviously, in the last 15 months, we're very excited about the partnership with Zimmer Biomet, where we have a relationship that we give them a custom version of the T-Mini robot, which they sell with their Persona implant. That's not truly open platform either, but at least it's offering one technology that covers a much bigger segment of the market. This is where we're going in future. And if there's any of my friends from Stryker, DePuy, Smith & Nephew in the audience, please don't throw up at me. Please don't throw anything at me. But that's our vision. And I think that we're going to get there because people who use robotic surgery and hospitals and ASCs that buy robotic technology are going to insist on it. And that's why I have confidence in saying that we will get there. It's just a question of when. And if you're like me, I don't know what a handheld robot looks like, because a robot for me is a big, big base and a robotic arm. And then you've got all this going on, right? I didn't know what a handheld robot concept was until I took the position at Think. And I only took the position at Think because of the handheld concept that was invented by Joel Zuhar, who's in the audience today. And when I saw it, the light bulb went off. So let me show you what it is. So the value in robotic total knee replacement is in personalization. Personalization cannot be achieved with a one brand fits all mentality. That's why we're driven to be the open platform implant agnostic technology in this market space. And we do have AI. Everyone's got AI. I can't walk out of here and not say I've got an AI badge, but we've got a specific type of AI in our product. It's called decision tree artificial intelligence. So the system responds to the physician's movements and the instruments that they bring into the field of view. And it is super efficient because it adapts the workflow to those physician-driven movements. So time up.
That's great. Thanks, Stuart. So I think the agnostic platform makes a lot of sense for sure, because, you know, for example, my group's building a new surgery center right now, and the debate amongst surgeons is, number one, do we even spend the money on a robot? Because you're talking a lot of money generally. And the answer right now is no. But then you have a doc who wants, you know, DePuy's platform, another wants Stryker's platform. Can you tell us a little about like the cost savings, other than the fact you don't have to buy 2 or 3 robotic systems, which most surgery centers, ASCs can't afford. But what's the cost and setup look like with your system as opposed to, say, a traditional robotic system? You don't have to give me exact numbers, but as a percentage savings, or is it similar cost? Or
you and I need to speak after this.
Yeah, we'll buy one tomorrow.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Shake.
Sold.
All right. So our system is spectacularly good for a surgery center. The footprint is so much smaller. The workflow efficiency is so much better. We can accommodate now 40% of the physician's choice in implants. And within the not too distant future, we will cover 100% of the market. You heard it here. Our price point is about half that of a traditional large format robot. And with our robot, you get 2 of the T-Mini. So you've got 1 nav system, which sits overhead, so it's out the way, and 2 T-Mini. So robot to robot, it's about a 75% discount.
Sounds great. Well, thanks a lot. And the last statement I'll make is, just all these solutions are great. I really would love to see next year how we can pair some of these solutions together, right? I mean, we've got imaging, we've got rehab, we've got AI doing all this great stuff on gathering data. Like, I would love to see people tie some of this together. So thank you.
It's becoming clear that technology in healthcare is no longer futuristic. It's here, now. The innovations we've seen at DocSF over the past decade are finally at our doorstep, ready to transform care. Our final episode will feature Mohan Nair, who closes the 2025 conference with an inspiring talk on why we should see ourselves as explorers rather than innovators. You won't want to miss it.